Welcome to the Fastcast. I'm John Nicolaitis, Slowpoke number one.
I'm Slowpoke number two, David Chalante.
I did mine the wrong way around.
Well, it's not the wrong way around, it's just the different way around. Let's celebrate diversity, John.
Yes. Can you see me try to do the math to find out if that's actually offensive or not?
I don't think it's offensive. I think it's referential.
Yes.
It's not deferential, just referential. It's not really a joke. It's just adjacent to something that exists, so...
Welcome to the podcast where we use words to explain things, except John doesn't know what words are, so he hears the word deferential and he goes, is that referential?
Well, right now you're kind of being a little bit deferential.
Oh, shit. I'm going to stop. Everyone, stop making me be deferential.
Welcome, everyone, to the podcast. I'm just going to take over from here. Get moving again.
I'm going to take over again, because we are not doing a structured thing. We're just two slow pokes. Just chilling down.
Taking it easy after a exhausting week for very much you and also a little bit me. So, yeah. John, why don't you tell the fine listener how you are today?
I never thought one man could miss a train ride so much until I became that man, the man who misses the train, who misses that clickety-clack of the track, that beautiful sound of the train, and the conductor going, all aboard, and not that that happens either, but trains, God, I miss them. My commute has become a half-hour drive, a 15-minute train ride, a 15-minute tram ride to work every day, minimum. That's if everything goes well, which it never does. So usually it's about an hour and a half commute there and then back every day. And as every person who knows me, yes, you, right there, you who know me, you're listening going, yes, I've heard John complain about trains. You've all heard. And now everyone else who listens, yes, you, the other listeners who do not know me, you get to hear me be frustrated by the lack of train in my life.
Yeah, travel sucks.
Yes.
Travel sucks.
And then when it gets more difficult, it sucks even more.
Yeah.
And then when someone asks me to operate a motor vehicle for more than half an hour...
What the fuck is up with people who like driving? What the fuck? No, hey, no, it's a Sunday. No, I'm going to go for a drive.
But see, this is completely different. If you just want to hit the open road, I'm with you. The wind in your hair, the flowers in your hair.
The crotch rocket between your meaty leather-clad thighs.
God, erotic. There's nothing wrong with going for a drive like that. I'm all for it. But if I have to drive to a place and back from a place every day on the same road because it's the fastest road and I'm in traffic and I've got to concentrate, but not enough so like my mind can wander while I'm driving, but not completely wander because then I'll die in a metal coffin.
Yeah, it takes so much energy to operate a motor vehicle responsibly, and I think the kinds of people who act like driving's not a big deal probably aren't very safe drivers.
It's not only the drive, it's the driving through peak hour traffic. So if I miss my train, for example, I then have to drive to work, and I have to drive on the busiest roads in Melbourne in the morning to get there.
I drive to and from work every day because there's no public transport route between my home and my work. But thankfully, it's only a 25-ish minute drive one way, and it's not perpendicular, but sort of like a 45-degree angle to peak traffic. So there is traffic, but it's not oppressive. Yeah. And I'm very, very grateful that getting to my job is not difficult, at least as far as it could be. And I think that that's a big reason why I have a little bit more energy than some folks do after their full exhausting work days.
The really interesting thing about it is it's kind of forced me to question how I deal with my frustration and anger, because I've been getting very angry about being in this situation. And it appears that I've just been like, while not bottling it up, but I don't think I've been...
Because
it hasn't been at a point that's actually caused it to become a problem. I've never looked at strategies into it.
Yeah.
And because it's built up, I'm like, whoa, man, there is so much here. You should probably find a way to work with this.
Yeah, I think that it's a very particular challenge to deal with frustration of that kind, because when you have a specific frustration, like I had this week, a big emotional thing that happened, but it's a singular event. It is one thing, and I know that I'm going to go through a process of dealing with it over the next couple of days. Thankfully, we had a public holiday that helped me dedicate some time to dealing with
that. I wish every week was like that.
Just had a day right in the middle.
Mini weekend.
But dealing with that is very different to dealing with a kind of frustration that you almost, as an adult, feel like you shouldn't even be frustrated
by.
Your brain is a little bit like, well, all I have to do is not be bothered by it, because I shouldn't be bothered by this. I'm an adult.
I'm an adult. I have a job.
I'm too mature to be bothered by this and take it out on other people. Look, but you don't choose how you feel, and you don't get to just magically erase frustration like that because you quote-unquote should be above it. And so the idea that it's taken you a little bit of time to recognize that you need strategies for that doesn't surprise me at all. That completely mirrors my experience with that kind of shit.
It turns out that public transport has a critical hit against my defenses.
You have a vulnerability.
Yes, yes, yeah.
You take double damage from public transport.
Weakness to delays in commuting.
I hope things get better soon, I suppose.
1 week. It's just 1 week.
Yeah,
it's
but they've been said 1 week before, haven't they?
Yeah, they did. They said
hope for the best, plan for the worst is the adage I would go with on this kind of situation.
You're right, David. It'll never stop. It'll be like this forever.
Oh no.
Single tier. How have you been?
Pretty good.
There's some stuff there.
I mean, I'm good now. Like, shit happened. I went through it and I'm fine. Some projects I was working on were delayed, but emotionally I have gone through what I need to go through because, like I was saying, when it's a really obvious thing, you deal with it.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're anything like me, you recognize, oh damn, I'm going to have to dedicate conscious effort to addressing my emotional state around the situation. I'm going to need to monitor myself and make sure that I am going through what I need to go through, accepting my emotional state, doing the healthy, emotionally aware things that emotionally healthy people do.
That we all are.
That's hard. That's always hard. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad that at this point in my life, I know what I need to do with big grief-related things like that, rather than the day-to-day drudgery of...
Sorry, trains. Yeah, like.
Yeah. The death by a thousand cuts, you know, that stuff is very hard to deal with. But the big things like, oh, a friendship ended, that's manageable because it's finite.
Oh, I just thought of a whole bunch of dark things to sacrifice to get the trains back, but I won't do any of them.
Let's not. No. Let's not, John.
Because I would have done it at the start, not at the end. It would make no sense.
Yeah, at this point, it's sunk cost, right? Yeah, like, I've dedicated this much time to emotional trauma on my slow trains.
Exactly. Now I've got to deal with it.
But to make that worth it, I've got to hold out. Exactly. Gambler's fallacy.
I'm glad that you have strategies in place to deal with critical events in your life.
Yeah.
This is a good thing.
I'm glad too. Yeah! Wasn't always like that. Gross. So we're here to talk about a couple of things this week that aren't our less than stellar emotional states, but it's good that we can share that with one another. So thank you, John, for listening.
And with you, the listener.
But one thing that is actually apparently pretty cool that's going on in your life at the moment is you bought a new video game.
I did. I was like, John, you know what you need to do? Buy a new video game. You know what, John? How about you buy like a brand new video game that only just came out?
I know you don't actually... Fly in the face of the fucking Slowpoke's bullshit.
Yep. And I bought Frostpunk, which is the new game by 11-Bit Studio, who brought us This War of Mine.
Yeah, which is a game that we've covered on the show.
Yeah, look at that. I remember all the names as well. Not even prompted. They're written down.
So I've not played Frostpunk. I did not even know that Frostpunk was out until you linked something on Facebook a couple of days ago.
Yeah, I did share it in the group. I was really excited for Frostpunk to come out. I saw the trailer and it depicts this steampunk world where basically the ice blizzard apocalypse has happened.
Yeah.
And everyone has to huddle around this last remaining giant generator for heat. It's the center of their city, and their city spreads radially out from it in this crater up in the north somewhere.
Mm. Well, I thought that was interesting in the trailer because I feel like, it might be a fantasy world, but I feel like London is the city that they all come from. But in this trailer, apocalypse happens, they build a big snowplow, basically, they pile a couple of thousand people onto it, and then they're like, we've got to go north to escape the cold. I'm just sitting there thinking, counterpoint, how about south, guys?
Yeah.
How about south instead?
I think the only reason they go north is they know there's a magical generator that makes heat there. Because when I first...
But you don't know that that's what they're heading to until the end of the trailer.
When I first watched it, I was like, no, guys, but that's not where it's... That's the wrong way around, isn't it?
Yeah.
Upon finding this generator, you realize that that's what they're heading towards. And it's basically just a power plant, but it's not insulated, and so it heats up the city. It was like, oh, we'll put this remotely in some mining town somewhere, because who fucking cares about these miners? But now that the world is frozen over, everyone's like, oh, thank God for these lax safety measures.
Because I was thinking about this as well, right? It's got that steampunk aesthetic that you're talking about, very Victorian London era. You know, this game that you play, for the sake of people who aren't aware of it, it's pretty much a community management sim, except in massive danger all the time.
Yeah.
So you're building up the city, you're managing that, you're managing resources and stuff, I imagine. I've not played it myself.
Yeah, those are all true. You know, once you turn on the generator, people are very hesitant for it to ever turn off ever again and will get very upset if they have to sleep in the cold, for example. So you're constantly making sure that you can feed coal into this machine. And if you want the heat to spread out in your city and the outer rings of your city to be warm, you've got to feed more coal into that engine. So as your city grows, you're just endlessly increasing the amount of resources.
I was thinking about the era that they chose, though, that late 1800s point, because it's basically the last point in civilization when nuclear power was not an option. Yes. And so you've got this very, very, very hungry, finite resource that you're feeding into this engine, because if you were like, oh yeah, we enriched some uranium, so we'll be fine for the next like 600 years.
Exactly, yeah. It would definitely change the tone of the game. And it does not have that sense of urgency. And once you've got the generator running, foreboding that kind of happens. I've only just played the basic mode, which sort of starts you off with the survivors from the Expedition North huddled around the wreckage of the generator itself. Some of the mechanical ideas remind me a lot of the base building in This War of Mine. Obviously translated into a city environment, which is, it feels like much more of the focus is managing large groups of people, but you still have to worry about individual people's health. So people can get sick and you have to be going to hospital.
What level what's the scope? Like, how many people do you tend to have in your city near the beginning?
At the start of the game, you have 80 people there.
Okay. Mm. And I imagine that when you get like a really bustling city going, we're talking probably in the low thousands.
Probably. Definitely hundreds. But I haven't played very much of it, but it's a puzzle there that looks really intriguing. And also, after you've played it, there's some other modes as well. A friend of mine who really enjoyed the mechanics of This War of Mine, when you play that, there's actually lots of different starting configurations that make that make the game harder. So I'm very interested to see if that translates into this game, which I feel is more mechanically what I'm after.
See, we've talked about Frostpunk before. I think we did an episode near the start of this year about what we were looking forward to that was coming out this year. One of the things that I said I was interested in was that I wasn't a huge fan of This War of Mine. I didn't feel like it really committed to its premise about being a civilian surviving in a war zone and the psychological effects and trials of that. Whereas this game, because it's a little bit more fantastical and significantly less personal, like you said, you start with 80 people, whereas the most people you can ever have in This War of Mine, I think, is 4. That all appeals to me. And I think that the kind of mechanical and thematic mismatches that didn't really go together very well in This War of Mine, the mechanics would work much better in a game like this, which is significantly more impersonal and more large and community focused rather than it is necessarily individual focused.
And the choices you have to make are more explicit. People will ask you, you know, it's like, hey, we don't have any shelter. You need to build a shelter. Can you do that for us? They'll make demands.
So you're like you're like the mayor, I guess.
Kind of, yeah.
Or the governor or something.
The SimCity abstracted eternal mayor that watches the city is unfireable.
The specific leader they chose in Civ 6 that for whatever reason lives for millennia. Hey, I'm Elizabeth II. I guess I was born in 4000 BC.
And then also, not only do you have the small stories where people ask you for things, you choose different moral paths to go on.
Okay.
You can enact laws like 24-hour shift, because here's the thing, there's a work day in this game.
That's very cool.
Yeah, so people go to sleep at night, and they have breaks during the middle of the day when they're mostly at work. It's like a 9-to-5 kind of day, basically. And this took me by complete surprise when I started playing the game. And I'm like, oh, we need to get these resources so we can turn on the generator. Oh, why is everyone going away from the... Oh, no!
See, I'm not overly surprised by that, because a lot of the more recent Sim Cities and City Skylines and that kind of thing, they build day-night cycles into their models of traffic and that kind of thing. It's going to be very different in a game like this where if the generator goes out, oh no, a third of my population is dead.
I think in those city building games, you can like magically construct things and have like a 24/7 construction
clue. Yeah, you can press pause and build a bunch of roads and hospitals and stuff in effectively a nanosecond and then unpause the game.
Whereas in Frostpunk, time plays a factor, and there's a tracker right at the top that sort of tells you when the weather's going to shift to get colder and when it's going to get warmer and stuff like that.
This week, because of the aforementioned emotional stuff, I was looking for a time sink game like this to help manage myself. And whenever I looked at anything, I was like, I've played so much City Skylines. I've played so much Kerbal Space Program. I've played so much Prison Architect. None of these games are grabbing me. I am going to buy this game when I get home today. I want this game so bad, John.
Who cares about...
I want to watch Dickensian orphans get frostbite in the middle of the snow because I failed to put enough coal in my hunger engine.
Now, you know what, David? If you want, you can put those Dickensian orphans to work.
Oh, good. I look forward to it.
But anyway, that's just like a primer for Frostpunk. Hopefully... we'll play it a bit more, see how we've...
Yeah, yeah, we might have another conversation about it after I've given it a bit of a go, because I'm interested to see how deep a lot of the themes about labor go and Machiavellianism go, as far as a developer that has very specifically tackled heavy themes before.
You start with adaptation, which is the law set that you start the game with, but I know for a fact that there is order and there is religion. Okay. And there are like other ways to sort of move things.
So, yeah.
Again,
keep like this society functioning in a very, very desperate time.
Yeah. Like this War of Mine. I think it's really well accomplished for an indie game, and I'm really excited to play more for
it. Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to start talking about TV now. So you've seen Lost in Space, right?
Yes, I did. When I was a kid, me and my family watched the movie, like the 90s themed kind of...
The one that's got Joey from Friends in it?
Yeah. God, my favorite role for Joey.
So that's the only thing I remember about that movie, and I've seen no other Lost in Space than that.
He has an armored suit and he shoots spider crabs.
I remember that he has a contact lens that he uses when he flies a jet.
Oh, yeah.
That gives him a HUD.
Yeah, yeah. There is
everything I remember is about Joey from Friends.
That's the part where he fights the cyborgs who hate humanity and want to destroy the warp gate, which is part of the plot of that movie.
What a fucking dumb movie. This is where they put the X-Men in black leather. And...
yeah, yeah. I need to rewatch that original one, especially after watching the new Netflix series of Lost in Space.
Yes. So I want to know, how do you feel about this show overall?
Overall. Hey,
thumbs up, thumbs down?
Thumbs up, thumbs down. Ultimately, I will have to go thumbs up.
Yeah, you finished it, right?
No, I have not.
Oh, okay.
I am very bad at finishing things.
So I finished it over a couple of days. I like it. I like this Netflix
thumbs
show.
Thumbs up.
And if we're talking about the 90s movie being really inspired by Blade and X-Men and the 90s dark leather grunge thing.
Which is such an interesting thing for a show like Lost in Space to be inspired by.
Yeah, but you know what I'm talking about. Like that cultural movement of that aesthetic and things being a lot more grounded and serious.
I did watch The Matrix, David. I know what it was like.
This one, probably a better comparison to make for this is something like Mass Effect, where it's a lot more grounded in real science. The two main characters are basically M. Shep and Fem Shep.
Oh my god, you point that out and that's kind of true.
Yeah, and one of them chose soldier as the class and one of them chose engineer as the class.
Yes.
And that's how they approach all of the problems in the show.
Yes.
And so the first half of it, I think, is really good. As far as the premise of it goes, the characterization goes, the actor choices go, a lot of it's really good,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, I was... The moment-to-moment beats and the way the story sort of goes in the first couple of episodes that I watched, I was really impressed by how engaged I was. Because was this like an original TV series in like a TV serial? Like in the 80s or whatever?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, Lost in Space is like super, super old. Yeah. We're talking like the 50s.
I have no idea what it is. Like, I've never seen any of that super old stuff. I've got no context for it.
It's not Trek, but it's a little bit Trekkie. It's a very serialized, oh, what's the danger of the week? Danger, Will Robinson, danger. And got a big glowing head and...
robot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that that's kind of where it came from, but all I like we've started this intro with. All I know is that 90s movie with Joey and space crabs.
How you doing, space crabs?
So it kind of feels like an adaptation that I don't really understand the source material, but from the premise that I read, this feels like a more on the nose kind of adaptation for like a serial kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it has that Netflix kind of overrush.
Yeah, it's
kind of
very
feel.
Much a series designed to binge. It has a continuity from episode to episode. You need to know what's happened in the previous one to know what's going on in this one. It's, 10 episodes, 13 episodes long?
Something like that.
Where would you say you roughly are up to?
I think I'm only like 4 or 5 episodes in.
So. Yeah, so you're still at the point where I was like, this is a very, very, very good show.
Yeah, I was like, oh, this is how this is going to go. Like when they were introducing all the characters and they were introducing the setup with the spaceships and the robots and all that kind of stuff, which is as much as I'll talk about any of that. I was very like, whoa, weird and cool and exciting. And the effects too in this. I've watched some full budget recent movies that I feel like don't have effects as nice as this Lost in Space.
Yeah, yeah.
TV
it's very, very good and it's very nice to look at, especially in something that, like I was saying before, is trying to be quite grounded in a more realistic kind of science. Yeah. And so when they run into a problem, like getting a ship into space, they need to work things out like orbital mechanics and delta V and all of that kind of shit. They actually have to sit down and do the science. And they don't inundate you with that shit, but they make it very clear that getting things into orbit is not easy. You don't just Millennium Falcon straight up into the air.
I think my biggest annoyance with the show, and it's so petty, is we're going into pet town, petty town, population John. All the cupboards fly open all the time.
What is up with that?
And that's the one thing I can remember about how we build spaceships. It's like the Star Trek thing where for some reason every console explodes. In this, there's like every time there's a crash, it's like every cupboard just bursts open. Yeah. And things
Especially because there's no artificial gravity on their ships, right? Things would be fucking stowed. Yeah, what are you doing?
Latched, locked down, in nets. Like you wouldn't have a room that was, I don't know, a circle surrounded by cupboards where all the people were. And those things were just full of knives and shit. Like,
one thing, while we're on Pet Peeve Town, there's this point where they get the ship down and they're like, okay, we're probably not going to get off this planet for a little while. We may as well, you know, set up like we're going to live here for a little bit. And so they do this thing where they deploy the baffles of the ship. Yep. And I'm like, oh, cool. So it's going to kind of expand, turn almost into like a little colony hub something.
Like a camper van.
Yeah, like a camper van. Maybe it's, you know, you'll have these dormitories that expand out. So this is going to be very cool. They pop out like 4 meters on each side and stay there. what happened? What space did you gain from that? For something where everything else is so thought out about like how many supplies they have and how they all eat MREs because they don't have a way to cultivate food and shit like that. It's just like, oh yeah, I guess we'll expand the size of the ship for no reason.
They couldn't afford to spring out for the deluxe model. They only got the standard plus. So it's like, oh yeah, the sides come out, but they don't go that far, so you don't get a new room. But you do get some more leg room, maybe, you know? The bedrooms increase a few inches.
What do you think about Dr. Smith?
Oh, that was weird.
Weird?
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was an interesting and good direction for the show to go in and have that character and the way the character's explored. I liked it. But because I'm such a fan of the weird 90s movie, because it came out right to suck me in with nostalgia and it will forever like be that thing, I'm still worried about terrorism and stuff like that. But I'm glad they went with that kind of... That's a very interesting take.
Yeah. See, I like it, but I don't really have a point of reference. I've never watched the original show. I barely remember the 90s movie. I think it's good the way the character is motivated for the most part. Yeah. And one thing they do well is that they make her motivations clear as she's going. And so when she's doing this 3-episode long manipulation of different characters into different things, you know what the point is. Yeah. Like, I find it in some shows it's a little bit confusing when you'll have a master villain doing their master manipulations and you're just kind of sitting there going, what do they get out of this? And then when you get to episode 9, it all becomes clear. But up until that point, you're just like, can you stop just being a fucking jerk? But with Dr. Smith in this, you know what she's trying to achieve.
And I think that's the most important when you've got someone manipulating and Machiavellian. If you don't...
You said Machiavellian. I don't think you know what that word means.
Oh, Machiavellian is of like controlling things from
behind the scenes. No, those are machinations. Machiavelli was the guy who said being a good ruler and being a good person are not necessarily the same thing.
Yeah, cool. But that's colloquial. Like people will use what I just did.
No, you can only really do that in a point of leadership, though. Like, if you're Commander Shepard, you can have a Machiavellian approach.
Okay.
But you can't really have a Machiavellian approach if you're just some criminal. It's a political philosophy about organizing governments and that kind of thing.
I did not know that. I also don't know, like, I don't know the source material. I just assume Machiavelli was
prince.
Some guy. No, the prince.
Machiavelli was a political philosopher who wrote The Prince.
Ah, books, you say?
Ah, yes. The Renaissance. I have heard of this.
That's where Mikey A, he made the helicopter. All of us are saying
that's where the Ninja Turtles were.
Leonardo, DiCaprio, Caprese.
Peter Capaldi.
Yeah, Capaldi. Oh, no. We're venturing into terrible town.
Peter Capaldi probably wound up in the Renaissance in one of those episodes, right?
Of the Doctor Who. Yes, I know what you're talking about now.
Now we're in your wheelhouse.
Fuck
this political philosophy bullshit. Now we're going to talk about the BBC.
Yeah. Why is that my wheelhouse?
I don't know.
Because it's not books. Literally everything else. There's books and there's everything else. So, apart from learning what Machiavellian is, when you know what a manipulator is manipulating towards...
Yep.
It helps give you context for their actions. And it also helps you know if they're bullshit. Right? Because sometimes they'll backfill in things, or the characters will do things that don't make any sense and you don't understand why. And it's not a puzzle. It's not interesting to watch the puzzle unfold if you've got no idea where it's going.
Mm.
So it's good that they didn't do that.
One of the things, we're going to get into a little bit of mild spoiler territory now. I'm going to talk about what is honestly my biggest criticism of the show, which is that once you get to like episode 6, the decisions people make that fuck up their situation stop having a justifiable other side to it. So there's a point where they're trying to build a signal and one of them's like, oh no, we're short on lights because one of them was broken in transit. And the head of the colony blows up. He's like, we can't afford these mistakes. We're in too dire a situation. And it's kind of meant to make him look like a prick. But at the same time, you're kind of like, I can understand why he's being so hard and so frustrated because they can't afford to fuck up. Later on, there's a bit where there's a ship dangling over the edge of a cliff and they're holding it down with these anchors. And the same guy, the head of this community, is like, okay, cool, we got everything we need from the ship. Cut the anchors. Let's get out of here. There's a guy still in the fucking ship.
Oh, jeez.
Right? And they're all just like, cool, let's cut them. Bye. And the guy miraculously survives. And the dude who cut the rails was just like, oh, I'm so glad you made it. All right, everybody, let's go. And nobody is like furious at this dude for not doing a basic fucking head count before this guy almost dies. And there are so many problems that occur in the community because of shit like that.
And they counter to the characters and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. So there's one point where they need fuel and they have to choose between whether or not a person dies or they get the fuel. That's a hard moral choice.
Yep.
And they go one way or the other and you kind of get why the decision was made. But then there are points later on where they're in a room where they can't make any noise or shit will go very bad and a guy just leaves his radio on. The radio is just on.
There's no,
and no one's all like, come in, roger, roger. And then all the shit goes to hell because the fuckwit didn't do the basic fucking thing that you should do when you're in that room.
And like, I get that sometimes you have that in a story to create tension.
Yeah.
I get that. But it becomes more difficult when you basically have a bunch of astronauts.
Yeah.
Astronauts are some of the most practical people who go through tests and procedures to ensure they remember things.
The Martian, I think, is a very good movie, but a little after it came out, a lot of people were like, oh, it's not that great when you think about it. And yeah, sure, whatever. But at the very least, when shit goes bad, it isn't because some idiot made a dumb choice that was stupid.
Yeah.
And I think that when we've had something that is so much like, okay, we are going to think, we're going to do everything carefully, we're going to double check everything. Everything I do is going to be monitored by the people back home so I know that I don't fuck up. And we are going to be calm and use rationality to get ourselves out of this really fucking hard situation. But then you just have some dude who's all like, oh, I'm going to do this instead because emotions or whatever. It makes it so much harder to fly.
I haven't watched those episodes, so I don't know how they balance it,
yeah.
But I can understand why you'd be frustrated with it.
There's one point, like, they're trying to achieve something, and it will benefit everybody. It is better for absolutely everyone.
Everybody?
Absolutely everybody on the whole planet, a part of the whole community.
That's a lot of things.
It's a lot of people. There is nobody who should not want this to succeed. But 15 seconds before the thing succeeds, a character interrupts it for no reason.
You know what? That's like me canceling a start game inside of a Call of Duty match or something like that.
Yeah.
It's just like being a jerk.
Yeah. And the thing is, this character only had to wait 15 seconds and then they could have interrupted it if they wanted to, but they chose to do it then for no other reason than to screw this thing up.
Ugh.
And then like two episodes later, they solved that same problem because, oh, look, we found it in a cave. All right, bye, we fixed it, bye. Mm. And so, like, the longer the season goes on, a lot of the tension is arbitrarily ramped up and arbitrarily ramped down, and that kind of is frustrating towards the end of it.
Okay, it's like they kind of ran out of all those good kind of story beats.
Yeah, and so there's a couple of structural issues about that I find kind of exhausting because it was, at that point it was very obvious. It's like when you're watching a J.J. Abrams show like Lost, and every time they get close to solving the mystery, they pull it away and obviously change what the mystery is. Yeah. And it gets to a point where you're like, there's no end game here. I'm just getting strung along. You're and when just- they're doing arbitrary problem, yeah. arbitrary solution.
They're just telling you kind porky of, pies.
You feel that, okay, I am in this rope. They're just trying to hook me for the next episode and next episode and next episode. Whereas the first half of the season was really compelling to watch just on its own merits and cool. just on the premise and the universe and the characters and stuff like that.
Well, that's a bummer, but yeah. I guess, you know, just put the show on Saturday morning, just watch the whole thing, and your life will move on. God, binging is weird. I have no problems leaving the show halfway through if I start getting bored. So.
Yeah, like you said, it's weird. Because I was binging, I was like, well, I may as well just finish it.
Like I said, I really like how it starts, so I might go back, but I'm not in a rush, to be honest.
Yeah, and I haven't exactly given you a huge reason to go back, especially since the best part of it is near the start.
Also, you know, after watching the start, I was like, I'm fine. That's enough. I got the families there. I got a bit of nostalgia. I'll probably just go back, watch the 90s movie, laugh at how shit it is, and then Lost in Space can go be more lost.
Yeah. Overall, I still think pretty good. I'm glad I watched it.
Thumbs up.
Well, I suppose that does it for another Fast Cast.
So our next game coming up will be one of my favorite games, Metro 2033.
Yeah, this is on the list because you put it there, and I'm going to be up front.
Yep.
This is one of the ones I'm the least excited for. I want to play this game because you love it, yep. and you have talked about it for basically as long as we've been friends, but I've never actually played it.
I've even created a role-playing game set in the Metro 2033 universe. That's how obsessed I am with it.
Yeah, you can tell you're a fan of something when you make a D&D campaign around it.
Yeah, there's a period of my life where I basically exclusively played Ukrainian games and stuff like that, and this is one of the standouts.
I was having a chat with a mutual friend of ours recently, a friend of mine, an acquaintance of yours, yeah. and even they, when I mentioned we were doing Metro 2033 because it's on the list, were like, damn, John loves those fucking Eastern European games, hey?
Oh,
he's all about that.
Oh, I want to get deeper into it. I have so much love for it.
So, I know a fair bit about Metro 2033.
That's because I've told you all the time,
exactly.
constantly.
I don't know, like, the plot and that kind of thing, but post-apocalyptic, live in subways because of nuclear fallout, mutants.
Bleak, depressing.
Depressing, sad, depressing,
dark.
Bleak, dark and bleak. So, I know all of that, and I played the first, like, 5 minutes of it once. And I was just like, I'm not in the mood for this, and never picked it up again. So like I said, I don't think I'm going to enjoy this, but I am excited to play it because I want to know why it means so much to you. And I think that after having played it, I'll probably gain an appreciation for it. I've just got to motivate myself to get invested into it. The one thing, though, that I really do love about this, and I think about it every single time I think about this game, is that the currency in the post-apocalyptic world...
Oh, yeah, this is great.
Are bullets.
Yes.
And so every time you fire your gun, you're effectively spending money. And yeah. I think that's such a fascinating mechanic. Mm-hmm. And I'm really interested to see how that plays out in the game.
I was just obsessed with the world idea when I first heard it. I've read the book. I adore it. I think it's a fantastic example of a linear post-apocalyptic story game. And I think that it has a lot of advantages in terms of narrative and stuff by being linear rather than Stalker is probably the closest example of a game, which is very vague in every way in trying to tell a story. So this actually reminds me of when I made you play Kane and Lynch. It's one of those games that I'm like, you might not like it, but there will be lessons to be learned in this experience.
When I came away from Kane and Lynch, I was really glad that I'd played that. And so I'm expecting and hoping for a similar thing here, even though, like I said, there's a big part of me, the part of me that enjoys smiling and having fun, that is not excited about going
Come with me, David, into the Metro, where we can be sad and miserable together.
And drink vodka.
And mushroom tea.
So that's our next game. As always, I've been Slowpoke number 2, David Chalante.
I've been Slowpoke number 1, John Aglaudis.
Thank you for joining us, and I hope you have a great week.